Rise and shine, football fans. Start your day the right way with Morning Footy, a podcast that covers every aspect of the global game, headlines, match previews, analysis, interviews, culture, fashion, and plenty of banter. Join as we track the thrills and spills of Europe's biggest title races, the business end of the Champions League season, a summer packed with international competitions, MLS, NWSL, and much more. Subscribe to Morning Footy.
Now you can feel like you're in the audience at the Ed Sullivan Theater with official Late Show with Stephen Colbert merchandise at ParamountShop.com. Shop t-shirts, mugs, accessories, and more. And Late Show Poncho listeners can take 20% off with code TLS20. That's 20% off at checkout on all Late Show products with code TLS20 at ParamountShop.com. It's the Late Show Poncho with Stephen Colbert.
My next guest is a comedian who co-created and starred in the hit comedy series Catastrophe. He's written a new book, A Heart That Works. Please welcome to The Late Show, Rob Delaney. Nice to meet you.
It's so great to meet you.
I mean, I certainly admired your work before.
Oh, thanks.
Catastrophe and a brief but memorable appearance in Deadpool 2, of course.
Oh, yeah.
People know you as a comedian, but you started off in musical theater. When and how did that change happen?
So, we were doing a national tour, a bus and truck national tour.
Okay.
I don't know if anybody knows what that means.
Of
Camelot. And
were you Lancelot?
I was Sir Lancelot.
If ever I should leave you.
I wouldn't do it in springtime. or any of the other seasons.
I could see you as a Robert Goulet.
Thank you.
Yes.
So we were doing that tour, and our bus broke down in Virginia one day when we were trying to get to West Virginia to do a show. And we didn't know if we would make it. But they got a replacement bus to us in time, and we barely made it. The show started at 7:30, and we got there at like 7:32. So we had to do a sound check before we went on, just to calibrate the mics. The three people who have to sound check are Guinevere, King Arthur, and Sir Lancelot. So you go out, you sing a couple bars, and you say a couple lines of dialogue. So Guinevere did that, then Arthur. Then I came out, and I was like, wait, they just like did some dialogue from the play, totally spoiling it for these people who came and
so
got a babysitter.
Is there.
Yeah, they're there. We had to do it in front of the audience. Yeah, important detail I left out. But so they sound check in front of them. And then I'm like, well, I'm not going to tell them any of the dialogue. I don't want them to know the story of Camelot before we begin, like they didn't already know it. And it's just like 2,500 old ladies in the audience.
I don't want them to know what shape the table is.
Precisely. So I was like, you know what? I'm just going to say some stuff about our day and about how our bus broke down on the bank of the Elbow River in Virginia. And so I did. And I just told them a little bit about our day. And people laughed. And I was like, oh, I don't do musical theater anymore. Now I do comedy. Like, I thought, I said a thing. And I, oh.
That's the drug right there.
Yeah, because musical theater was like, you know, a toke on some garbage weed. But making people laugh with things that you thought up yourself, that was the tie me off, you know, the good, the spoon, the good stuff.
Sure. Yeah, exactly. Dark image, but I agree.
Yeah.
Now, well, you have a new book. Mm-hmm. It's called A Heart That Works, and it's a memoir. It's funny, and it's painful, and it's really about love and often the pain of love. And tell the people what it's about.
Yeah, so my third son, Henry, around the time of his first birthday, got sick, and we didn't know what it was, and it took a while to get it diagnosed. It turned out to be a brain tumor, and he was... He had a big surgery and then chemotherapy and was disabled by the surgery to remove the tumor. And then we had, you know, some time in the hospital, 14 months in hospital and then 7 additional months at home. And then his tumor returned and he died. So that's what it's about. And it's about, you know, the time before and after that and how our family navigated it all.
That pain of a parent losing their child is something that people don't really even want to imagine. It's such a painful, especially if you have children of your own. It's too hard to contemplate. But you write that grief, quote, makes me want to make you understand.
Yeah.
What is it you want people to understand, and why is it so important for you to make us understand?
So I think losing a child is accurately billed as the worst thing that could happen to you, you know? Mm-hmm. And you immediately felt, you know, plucked out of, you know, the regular human race and just put over here and felt so separate and different and not understood. But we had also learned something so profound. We had seen sort of more deeply into the mechanism of life and love and fear and pain than we ever had before. And I don't know, we kind of wanted to come back to humanity, but we felt we had to, needed like translator devices and stuff before we could, you know, mesh with other people again. And so it was, I wanted to write something that helped kind of bridge that gap between, you know, something that many people would rightfully consider unimaginable and, you know, regular Joes just mm-hmm. walking down the street, whistling, you know, not knowing what that stuff is like.
Well, your son passed, would be 5 years ago this January, right?
Yeah.
He passed on your birthday, I understand.
He did. He did die on my birthday, which when he died on my birthday, my wife and I both sighed a big sigh of relief because one of my other son's birthdays is a few days later, and we were like, oh, thank God he didn't die on Oscar's birthday, because a little boy having his brother die sure. and then having his birthday torpedoed. So yes, my birthday was destroyed, and I don't have one anymore. I'm now ageless. but it's interesting because now, of course, on my birthday, I don't think about my birthday. I think about him, and it's a special feeling that hurts.
5 years actually isn't that long a time.
No.
And I'm curious, we say about returning, you know, to sort mm-hmm. of being feeling separated. And I know many people who have suffered great loss, and I, of course, put yours in that, they talk about the loneliness of grief.
Sure.
And the inability to make a connection with other people who haven't had that experience before.
Yeah.
And certainly the feeling is, I don't want you to experience this,
yeah.
but I wish you know what it felt. I wish you knew what it felt like, because
yeah.
then I would be less lonely.
Precisely.
How did you first, or how do you and your wife, and I assume your two other boys, mm-hmm. how do you first explain it? Like, is there a way that you first try to explain what this loss is like?
So that is, of course, very difficult, and you, as someone who has experienced profound loss, will understand words. I know I just wrote a book about it, but words are so much less useful than actions, you know? And so we sort of relax into the understanding we won't be able to explain it because it's impossible, you know? Mm-hmm. So you do become a lot more comfortable with mystery and questions after a loss like this.
And what's the mystery for you?
What's the mystery for me? Well, you see deeper, you like see through the veil. And so I know you see like the shapes and outlines of things that are much bigger and more powerful than what's happening in this day-to-day, our corporeal form and life.
That's the veil, sort of the quotidian concerns of the day.
Yeah. So you really get to put your hand through and put your hand on the pulse of something much more sort of majestic and terrifying and beautiful.
What is that thing, if I may ask?
I mean, it might be love, you know? I mean, a big problem for me is that my faith organ or whatever is growing in the years after his death, and there's a lot of love happening inside of me that I didn't expect. I mean, I started out very angry, you know? When I first started writing this book, I was like, I want to hurt people. You know, I want to pummel people. Somebody went to the bookstore for entertainment. Well, they deserve to be punished by my book about my sadness and my anger. And then over time, it just became more and more about love. So it was very educational for me.
How about your boys? It's going to be tough for siblings
because they're
so young. How old were they when he passed?
They were 3 and 5. Okay. I'm sorry. Forgive me. They were 4 and 6.
4 and 6.
Yeah.
So, I mean, know him,
have
a relationship with him.
Yeah.
How did you explain them or prepare them for this?
Well, you learn that you can't. I mean, a big realization for me watching them prepare for their brother to die and then grieving as I really realized, oh, you really don't learn anything in the decades between childhood and middle age that equip you to deal with this, right? You're no better equipped to deal with it than they are at all. You're hairier. You're more forgetful. That's about it. So there, the way that they dealt with it was instructive to us, you know, and beautiful. I mean, at one point, I remember visiting, or not visiting, I was there all the time, but in taking my oldest son, Eugene, home from the hospital after being with Henry for a while, and he just went bananas on me at age 5 and just started physically attacking me because he was so angry and upset. And so I just sat there like a punching bag, you know, and then he started crying and then kind of nuzzled up like a much younger kid into my arms. And you realize, like, that's a very healthy thing to do if you're that age and deal with it, you know? And, like, like I remember walking, coming into the kitchen and looking out the back window and seeing in the garden that same boy stabbing with a kitchen knife a cardboard box from, like, a package that he had written the word tumor on it and, like, not spelled it correctly, but was just stabbing a box that said tumor on it. And normally you'd, like, go take a kitchen knife away from your young child, but I was like, good work, son. You know, that's, you know, adults should do stuff like that because we try to stumble through and act like we're all right.
Here you are with your son, Henry, right there. Tell me about him.
Well, he's very beautiful. I miss his ears in my mouth. All my children's ears have spent an insane amount of time in my mouth. You have to put your kids' ears in your mouth a lot, I think, is a big part of parenting. Mm-hmm. So Henry was the third boy in right in a row. So there's not quite 2 years between the first two, then just over 2 years between Oscar and Henry. And so, you know, our house was pretty crazy with all these little boys. And he seemed to know right away he would have to be very serene and magnetic. And he wasn't like a screamer or a, I'm going to compete for attention. He would just be like a little sweet potato and magnetize you toward him. And so very lovely. But then, you know, 11 months before he became very visibly ill and vomiting a lot, which I should say it is... can be a symptom of a brain tumor for anybody, but particularly for a young kid who can't explain, like you or I would be like, hey, there's this pressure in my head or, you know, I'm having trouble seeing, but someone who can't talk can't do that. And so it was very hard to diagnose. The tumor was next to his brainstem and cranial nerves. So to get it out, they had to damage his brainstem. The doctors did an amazing job, but they're to get every bit of this terrible malignant tumor. So he was quite disabled afterwards, and he had to relearn a lot of skills, or even learn some of them, because he was so young, he hadn't even done a lot of the stuff that we do with these bodies. And so then he became the hardest worker I've ever seen in my life. I mean, it just astonishing to watch his drive as he learned how to do stuff and did his physical therapy. I mean, like, okay, one way that my wife and I can make each other smile is by saying the phrase high kneeling, because Henry had to learn. He'd be like down here, and then when he would do high kneeling, which was one of his activities, we would like cheer, like it was like the Super Bowl, freaking out, watching him high kneel. You know, so, like, it was just so beautiful to see the aspiration and the drive and the life in him was just amazing. And he was funny and mischievous. He would steal pens from nurses. He would summon different, like, a nurse. He'd be with one nurse and then make another one come in from the hallway. And he had a tracheostomy because his nerves that controlled his swallowing were damaged. So he had to learn sign language very quickly, and he did. His frontal lobe wasn't damaged at all. He was considerably smarter than either of us. And we would make him come in, and he would go like this, which meant it's time for you to sing me Eensy Weensy Spider, as they say in London, where I live. Here, that means itsy bitsy in American English. Over there, it's Eensy Weensy, just so you
that's
understand.
Itsy bitsy in metric.
Yeah. And so he would make everybody sing him Eensy Weensy Spider, and steal their pens, and, you know, make him kiss him. I mean, he was just magical.
Well, Rob, so lovely to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
And thank you for telling the story. It's so important for you to be able to share that with other people and for them to learn it.
Thank you very much.
The book is A Heart That Works. It's on sale now. Rob Delaney, everybody. Thank you for listening to The Late Show Pod Show with Stephen Colbert. Just one more thing. If you want to see more of me, come to The Late Show YouTube channel for more clips and exclusives.